It is Wednesday, January 29th, 2014, and this is episode 52 of the Defensive Security Podcast. My name is Jerry Bell, and as usual tonight, I am joined by Mr. Andrew Kellett.
Good evening from Snowpocalypse Atlanta, day two.
Yes, yes. It has been an interesting couple days, and that's why we're a couple days late with this show, so... You know, we were, I certainly wasn't stuck in traffic as long as you were, but, you know, it's been pretty disastrous here.
It is. It was crazy. And I know that a lot of folks who live in other parts of the country, I grew up in Detroit, and we looked at the South and went, what's wrong with you people? Why can't you drive in the snow? All I can tell you is it's not that simple. And once you're here and you see all the hills and all the ice and the complete lack of equipment... It's just not possible to drive. It's not that people suck at it. It's that it's just not possible. So
yeah, I challenge any northerner to stop their car halfway up a 4% grade on ice and then get going again.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been crazy. You know, not to completely derail the show, but, you know, as you mentioned, it took me 6 hours to get home from a lunch meeting yesterday that was... 18 miles away from my house.
Awesome. And, it normally only takes four, right?
Right, exactly. You know, three and a half.
All right.
We should stay on topic, but it's been crazy. Although, you know, one thing I will tell you is this has been a great example of something where unexpected event came in, completely disrupted the city. And it makes you wonder about what sort of planning, what sort of, you know, disaster recovery sort of thoughts you have in place and policies and plans. And what if your staff just can't get to the office? How are you going to deal with that? And this is a great example of that. You know, and also at a personal level, you know, I used to carry a get home bag in my car and foolishly didn't have it in my vehicle yesterday. A lot of people have been stuck in their car for 18 to 20 hours. Trying to get home. So, you know, it brings up a lot of sort of disaster planning and other thoughts about things that can happen just out of the blue.
Absolutely. You know, it's a good point. I know I was watching a news segment about how the Atlanta airport's kind of a disaster because the TSA agents are, you know, not working today.
And yeah, which, you know, I can understand that.
Yeah. Well, but I think that the point is, you gotta have a plan for that kind of thing, and not that we're all in charge of the TSA, but you know, what are you gonna do if you get snowed in or iced in or what have you? Do you have a plan to house and feed your employees that are on site and
you know, and do you have emergency supplies? Yeah, do you have emergency supplies?
Exactly.
You know, food, water. You know, the thing that's been a bit of a saving grace here is that we didn't lose power. If we had lost power, you know, this would have been a complete nightmare, which we often have with ice on trees, taking down tree limbs and taking down the power lines, because the power repair companies would not have been able to get out to fix them.
Yeah, it's a good point. Very good point. So, you know, because of the because of all the snow and whatnot, I was actually, you know, Verizon Wireless was down for quite a while, and because of that, I was not able to hook up with my friend Bob. So I don't have any Bob stories this week.
Well, has he been released from custody? Last we heard, he was still in the custody of the immigration folks.
Yeah. They took the. Not a bribe. That's against the FCPA. they took the payment.
A convenience charge?
So services were rendered and money was exchanged.
Oddly, in Bitcoin, which I didn't know was even accepted by the federal government.
You know, good point. So the first story we have is actually, this one is pretty new to me. So Coca-Cola lost 55 laptops over a 7-year period. And so this story is from Network World, and apparently an employee had been systematically stealing laptops. And what they later learned is that those laptops contained 18,000 personal records that included social security numbers and about 56,000 other records of sensitive information. And boy, you know, that's a tough nut. You know, there's not a lot of detail in the story as to how this exactly happened, but wow, that's quite a fail on a lot of levels. And, you know, obviously there's no indication on whether or not these laptops were encrypted or not, but kind of assuming they're not, since it's being treated like that. But I'm wondering, even if they were, you know, potentially this person would have had access to the password.
Yeah, this brings up so many fails from an asset management standpoint to failure to encrypt. You know, even if they had access to the password, you know, in kind of a cynical fashion, at least Cook could have said, well, it was encrypted, right? So they probably would have had to disclose, but don't know. It's an interesting query.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure there'll be more to come on that in the future.
You know, in a previous life at a previous company, I worked at a place where we had a problem where one of the IT guys was swiping laptops and shipping them to Africa. You know, no, sorry, it wasn't one of the IT guys.
It was a security guard.
Yeah, it was security guard and shipping guy. That's right.
Yes.
And, you know, so it's and it took us a while to figure out who was doing that. But
it was I remember the ultimate irony there was we didn't need security guards until we got security guards.
Yes, that is true. That is true. I think that was found out by hidden cameras, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, it was.
Finally recovered. It was. But yeah, so it's one of those things of have to know where your assets are. And for this to go on for that long without them noticing, that's bad, right? This comes straight up to know where your data is and know when it's missing. It could be gone for months and years, and you wouldn't know, and that's definitely bad.
Apparently up to 7 years.
Yeah.
So, all right, anyhow, the next story we have comes from, let's see, Computer Weekly. And the title is Researchers Uncover Indian Cyber Espionage Network. Now, the article actually describes a report by a company named Norman Shark, who I've never heard of.
Recently purchased, by the way. Norman Shark was just purchased by, I don't want to say this wrong. I know they got bought. I think they got bought by, you know what? I'm going to Google it real quick while you're talking.
Okay. Anyhow, you know, this is kind of old passé type news, except for the fact that really two things I wanted to highlight. Number one is this is apparently a completely private enterprise, right? So we tend to think about these, you know, APT espionage efforts.
Are you referring to Norman Shark or referring to the...
The Indian Cyber Espionage Network.
Ah, yes, indeed. Well, you know, we outsource everything else to India. Why not?
Well, and actually... That's a good point because I wanted to bring that up.
Oh, sorry.
In the article, well, no, it's a good segue, right? So the article talks about how these researchers kind of analyze the motives and methods of this APT group and found that they're pretty organized and there's evidence of pretty rigorous project management and releases. And I have to wonder, you know, U.S. companies, a lot of larger U.S. companies have set up that kind of infrastructure and done a lot of investment in training to build up capabilities in those very kinds of skills. And so here we see, you know, this entity being set up and using those tactics to, you know, build this this espionage network and developing custom malware and as far as I can tell by the article, you know, for hire attacks.
Yeah, it's interesting. And, you know, I think we're going to see more of this, right? It's, why not? It's a business venture. And it's something you might as well organize and make money at. Never mind that it's illegal. That's never stopped folks before.
No, that's for sure. And apparently this particular organization was uncovered as Norman Shark was investigating the Telenor breach in Norway.
So to give you a little background, Norman Shark was purchased by Bluecoat in December of 2013, and it is a not as well-known competitor of FireEye. So a very similar sort of virtual system sandboxing, detonation of malware sort of approach that FireEye takes is what Norman Shark does. And now they're owned by Bluecoat.
Interesting. You know, now that you say that, I want to say Norman is the name of a malware analysis tool, if memory serves correct. Hmm. So anyhow, that's probably why I was thinking it's kind of an odd name for.
It is an odd name
for a company.
Yeah, I just happened to have gotten a briefing from Bluecoat recently, talking about how they're a whole new company and they've made all these purchases and rebooted the company into all these new areas. And they were talking about Norman Shark, and I guess the name of the company is just Norman because the website is norman.com. Okay. I had never really heard of them before. Anyway, I guess it's not that pertinent to the story, but yeah, I think they're out of Denmark. I think they are Northern European based. Okay. Is what I think.
Which would make sense that Norway would bring in a local company to investigate a breach there. And yeah. Another interesting thing that I saw in the article is that, you know, while this group was apparently relatively advanced, they did not use any 0 days. They used apparently all well-known, already patched exploits.
Yeah, I was, you know. And I think we see that a lot. Like we talk about the really sexy O-days and, you know, really sophisticated attacks. But again, the bad guys only have to be as good and as clever as you let them be. So once again, it goes back to the basics. It goes back to the blocking and tackling of patching and asset management and all that stuff that we talk about over and over again. That isn't fun. It isn't sexy. And it's not like buying a cool new box to put on the network. But it matters.
Boring.
Yes, I am. That's what my girlfriend tells me all the time.
All right. Well, with that.
And don't even ask what my wife says about me.
But a bing. Oh, my. We just lost half of our 8 listeners right there.
It's true. It's because, you know.
So, anyhow, moving on. The next story we have is a report from RSA. And this report is a relatively long PDF analysis of a breach investigation they did. And they don't name the customer. And in fact, they go to fairly extensive lengths to not name the customer. And you know, they change a lot of the information they present to obscure who it was. But nonetheless, it's kind of interesting, and the method of attack centers around Cold Fusion. And in 2013 was a really bad year for Cold Fusion, as most people might remember. But there's some really horrible things about this particular story. So just kind of jumping in, RSA identifies the attackers as a hacking collective known as Shell Crew. Now, I hadn't really heard of them before. One of the things that really bothered me was this attack happened on June 10th, 2013, using the exploit CVE 2010-2861.
Classic. One of my favorites.
Which, you know, being 3 years old is a classic.
It's true.
So They used this vulnerability, which was a directory traversal vulnerability, to download a configuration file that had a hashed password. They brute forced that hash, and that gave them access to an admin part of the website, and they were able to create a scheduled job that downloaded a web shell. And from there, it was game on. And, you know, so they apparently this was obviously a IIS environment, and they just proceeded to totally compromise the environment. And they go through in this report a lot of detail on how persistence was maintained. And I thought there were some really interesting things in here that I guess I've seen it before, but I haven't seen it all packaged up in one attack like this. So, you know, they registered some, the attackers registered some custom DLLs in IIS so that certain kinds of requests would go to the DLL of their choosing, which makes it really difficult to detect, the attack traffic from something else, because, the attackers can request a page that doesn't exist and actually interface with your system. And that's kind of frustrating if you're a defender. They also modified one of the core DLLs basically to do a similar thing. They deployed this Trojan that I hadn't ever heard before called Daruzby, I think is how you say it, on perimeter servers in this organization's network. And Daruzby is pretty insidious. You know, it does a lot of the normal things to hide itself. But one of the things that I hadn't seen before is apparently it installs itself as a shim in the network, and it's watching network traffic, and it is looking for a certain pattern in the network traffic. And if it sees that pattern, it redirects, the rest of the flow into its process. And basically you can have, let's say, a legitimate IIS or DNS or whatever server running. And if an attacker sends this specially crafted network traffic, it redirects the rest of that flow into its process. And what that allows the attacker to do is connect to it using some legitimate port, right? So you're not, if you're a defender monitoring the incoming traffic, you're probably not going to be able to differentiate the attack traffic from something else, because it's only that little that little kind of innocuous header that's being sent, and unless you specifically know what to look for, you're not going to see it. But anyway, once it sees that, the rest of the traffic doesn't get sent to the process that it's supposed to. It now gets sent to the Trojan process for obvious purposes of command and control and all that fun stuff. Some of the other persistence mechanisms they used are kind of oldie but goodies. The RDP sticky keys backdoor. Holy cow. I can't believe people still do that. I guess it works. They used PSExec, and we see that quite a lot. And they use PSExec and RDP to move around laterally in the environment. And now one of the cool things I saw in this report was they had set up a proxy server, or at least one proxy server, on the edge of the network, and they used that proxy to route traffic from internal hosts that were compromised and needing to talk to the outside through their proxy rather than the organization's proxy, which I assume they assumed was being monitored. So this,
they clearly wanted to stick around for a while.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know where this comes in handy, this technique, is it's funny because I was just talking to somebody about this the other day. Those networks that have no default route set.
Yes.
Which you don't see very often, but you do see in old, big companies. I've seen it at some really large, old, old, old style companies.
Yeah.
I won't say who.
Okay. Oh boy. They did a lot of date time stomping on files to, obviously to inhibit forensic reports. They stole credentials and presumably they were doing the normal, pass the hash or cash credential, brute forcing, that sort of thing. So I got to thinking, what kinds of lessons or what kind of defensive strategies would I want to learn from this? And I just wrote a couple of notes down. Number one is, I think there's this, if anything, really highlights a need to do much better segmentation and isolation in your network, not only from a network and kind of functional level, but also from an Active Directory level. I can't tell you how many times I've personally seen it, and I read, these kind of disastrous, postmortem reports where, Active Directory just plays a front and center role because it's not well designed to be segmented. And so once an attacker gets a footprint, they're just able to use the credentials they've stolen everywhere.
Well, this comes down to convenience and, ease of administration being used against us. The challenge is, if you don't have a unified password system, it's even more difficult to manage your system securely. So you're kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't. And I think it just comes down to understanding the weaknesses you introduce when you go to a centralized password and identity management system. But you need something like this if you're going to manage a big environment. I don't, you're kind of almost forced to go down that path.
Yeah, and by the way, I didn't mean to propose that it's a bad idea. I guess my point is that when you're designing, for instance, Active Directory, you have a lot of opportunities to segment, the forest, as it were, into regions, right?
So yeah, very true.
Possibly the credentials that might exist on a server on the on your server DMZ might not work anywhere else in the environment. So that sort of thing. And I think
I would agree with that.
We talked a couple of weeks ago about a document that a government organization in Japan had put together, which describes a lot of those techniques. So go look that up. I think it was about probably 8 or 10 episodes ago. Another one was, scanning for proxies, right? Scanning for rogue proxies would be and I guess I would say scanning for rogue ports generally.
Well, here's the question. Do we know what port the proxy was even listening on?
No.
Certainly it's good to scan all your systems, but that's such an overwhelming amount of data, right? Random system X is listening on, UDP 5873. Well, does that mean something to me? I don't know.
Well, it probably doesn't, but if it wasn't listening to it yesterday and is today.
Well, that's a good point. All right, baselines and changes in baseline. Okay, I like that plan.
Another one is, and I know I've mentioned this before, but if you have, and by the way, you should, IPS on the outside and the inside of your network, you ought to be looking for PSExec. I think almost every IPS engine that I'm aware of has the ability to trigger on PSExec commands. And I know it's a convenient tool for administrators. So possibly you could, set up some kind of lockdown centralized system where all that would emanate from. But, this probably more than anything is one tool that is really being widely used to compromise Windows networks and effectively move around laterally. Another kind of going back to RDP, disable RDP and scan for it.
Yeah, I mean, unless you have a specific need for it somewhere for some odd reason.
Yeah, well, especially on your workstations, just it comes up over and over again as a problem. And then last is, going back to this. This started off with a 3-year-old vulnerability in Cold Fusion. Patch your crap.
Well, Adobe's not so great at that stuff.
Well, I'm pretty sure. I don't know for sure. I guess I need to go and research, but I assume that there was a patch for this, and whoever this organization was just didn't apply the patch. And I know that one of the challenges with Cold Fusion, with a lot of similar products, is you got to do a lot of testing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you know, there's sometimes some pretty big changes between versions that will break the applications. So anyhow, that was that one.
Yeah, it's chock full of interesting info though. Absolutely. And you know, you gave a great summary, but definitely worth reading.
Thanks. The next story we have comes from Network World, and boy, I'm just going to summarize the title to say punish careless employees. So this study, it's referenced in the article, and you know, we've talked about it before, right? But you've got to keep in context the group that has performed the study. And I believe this company is in the game of preventing phishing attacks or providing
They do a lot of online training and user awareness training.
Okay.
And actually are associated with Kevin Mitnick as well in a positive way. Yeah, they are in the business of user awareness training.
Thank you. Well said. Anyway, their study showed, based on a pretty substantial population, that about 16% of their sample population was prone to click on phishing links. And what they found was that once they, or the organizations that employ these people, kind of laid out the law and impressed upon these people that they would be held accountable for their actions, it fell down to just over 1%. And now, that sounds like a pretty remarkable thing, but what's not, and I guess I'm just a skeptical bastard by nature, but I have to wonder, you know, what's the other side? What's the other shoe that falls on this? Are they just not doing anything with email anymore?
Well, I had to go build my soapbox while you were talking, so I tend to agree with this statement. The problem that I've often seen with policy and procedure and, you know, acceptable use policies is there's no bite behind the bark. People get away with violating it all the time. So nobody respects or cares about those policies. And so if you actually held people accountable, right, like they're held accountable for other things, if you destroy your laptop carelessly, you're paying for the new one or whatever it may be. I do think that it gets people to actually start to care a little bit. And so I think when people, after lots of training and after lots of, you know, communication, and they know their expectations, if they still do something that is not what is expected of them or is, you know, outright told they shouldn't do it, that is their, for lack of a better term, malfeasance or at least, you know, willful ignorance. And there should be some sort of negative consequence. I think it's the only way you're actually going to get users to stop doing stupid stuff.
I guess the problem I have with that is, having been on the response side, I've seen some of the emails that people are falling for, and I have a really hard time punishing someone for opening an email that came from their manager.
Well, okay, you got to have some discretion here, right? But if it's obviously, you know, Prince Mubar from Nigeria offering them money.
Fair enough. I'm with you there.
Okay? Right?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm with you there. But I think it's a difficult thing to apply effectively. And, you know, I guess if you're a smaller shop, it might be more easy to manage. But, you know, I'm not in a small shop, and that kind of prospect scares the heck out of me.
Yeah, I guess if I take it up to a higher level, phishing links are designed by nature to exploit human behavior and social engineer. So that's a bit of a gray area. But in if you take it up a level to other willful violations of acceptable use policies, you know, taking company data and putting it on a Dropbox and taking it home to work with you because you just want to get some work done. No, not permitted, right? That's a very black and white.
Absolutely.
And people get away with that all
totally
the time.
Agree. Totally
all
agree.
The time. And there are no repercussions. There are no consequences most of the time. You know, your top sales guy doesn't have to worry about it because he's the top sales guy.
Right.
And I think when companies get serious, now there is a cost, right? It is going to slow down productivity. It is going to slow down getting stuff done. This is not, just a panacea to do this. There is a cost, and there's going to be a cost culturally. There's going to be a cost politically. You may lose some high performers. But I think ultimately, if you're serious about this, you have to start enforcing these policies. Otherwise, they're not respected.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it was one of the recent episodes, we talked about a story where I think there was a study done that in order for policies like this to be effective, they really have to be supported by the CEO level. Otherwise, like you said, it's meaningless, and they become optional. People get out of jail free cards because they're top in sales, and you've got to really get your management team to buy into it. Otherwise, you're building your house on sand.
Yeah, it's a tough problem. This is also going back to what we've said on other shows. I don't believe in user awareness training being all that effective. I think you have to do it, but I still think you have to back it up with technology controls. I think if you're just relying upon just your users to be smart, that has failed time and time again.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So the next story we've got comes from IT World Canada. And the title of this story is Assume Your Network Has Been Hacked, Says Cisco. And this is basically another article about a report put out by Cisco. And I thought it was interesting in some of the stats that they had cited. First, that was a pretty disturbing, was 91% of exploits target Java, and 76% of Java installs are running version 6, which is not supported. And they would know because I think they're pulling data from their WebEx community. So that's pretty sad. They apparently sampled 33 of so I guess they have the way I read it is they have 33 Fortune 500 clients, and they looked for traffic from those Fortune 500 clients going to known malicious domains, and every single one of them had traffic going to those malicious domains. Now, don't really know what that means, but, it doesn't sound good. They also point out that the IPS model of defending networks really doesn't work, which is interesting.
And yet they just bought SourceFire.
Yeah, I was just about to say the same thing because they're pretty big IPS player. Their point is that you really need to profile user behavior and alert on anomalies.
Okay, that's great, except if you go with their belief system, and I'll come back to if I agree or not in a moment, you've already been hacked. So if you're profiling against an already hacked environment, you're now profiling the hacked behavior into your baseline.
I don't think you were supposed to think that.
My bad. Well, you'll get the next group that comes in.
That's right. And I have seen hackers fight over servers. So,
it's true.
You might see that. And, another point they brought up was to determine what's valuable in your environment and really work hard to protect that. But
InfoSec 101.
Yeah, now I'm going to get on my soapbox for a second.
Uh-oh. Watch out. Stand back.
Yeah, I know. I don't pull it out very often, but here I go.
I try to get you to.
Here I go. this is a InfoSec 101 thing, right? But I see people do it horribly wrong every day in every way conceivable because they don't understand what the hell they're doing. They don't understand the technology. They don't understand the risks. They think that they are doing the right thing. They think they are protecting their environment, but they're not. They don't know what they don't know. And because of that, you know, they think that they've protected their database of credit card numbers. But you know what? There's a freaking clear line from their external website into this database inside their network, and they didn't really map it out because they don't understand all of the interplay between all of the systems. And you know, it's really awesome that you want to put this on an internal network and you want to put IPS on it, right? And then you don't do anything to protect the freaking workstations of the people who access this data because, you know what? Hey, I'm going to put, you know, two-factor authentication on this server, whatever the hell you're going to do. And somebody clicks on funnycast.exe and now your entire database is gone and you're looking around saying, what the hell just happened?
Praise Flying Spaghetti Monster.
Sorry.
No, it's good, man. It's awesome. Keep it up.
Yeah, actually, I have been thinking about, you know, in all seriousness, I have been thinking about how, as an industry, do we turn that into something that's more objective? Because right now, it feels like security architecture and security design and security engineering is not a science. It's more like a craft.
Yeah.
We're a bunch of craftsmen who do things from our own perspective and you know, hey, you know, we don't know that the boat we're building is going to have to survive 5-foot waves, you know? We just don't have that context.
Well, you know, it's funny. I was at a big meeting the other day with a bunch of coworkers, and I got into this big theoretical debate with a good coworker of mine who knows his stuff. But it was funny because he was taking a theoretical standpoint, I was taking a very practical standpoint. And it's funny how we were arguing, you know, about things from two different standpoints. And so that's prefacing to say, it would be nice if ... theoretically speaking, the security was with the data. It doesn't matter how it's being accessed, right? The security encompassed the data, and the data was within whatever sort of security mechanism we have. And there are vendors who are trying to do this all the time. But the problem is that also gets in the way of actually processing the data and utilizing the data, right? So we keep taking that perimeter of security, and I don't mean like firewall perimeter. I mean the bubble of security controls out a little bit further and out a little bit further so more people can touch the data. And, you know, especially those who have a legitimate reason to touch the data. But there are all sorts of point products and niche products that are meant to, you know, like the DRM sort of tools, digital rights management, put the security on the data itself, on the data blob, whatever it is. Databases are a tough one, but I don't know. I'm kind of this point's sort of wandering off on its own. But the point is we don't have a lot of good solutions for that problem. And maybe that's a fundamental shift in IT. That needs to happen.
Yeah, I think you're definitely right about that. But I think one thing we have to realize is that it's like a sieve, you know. There are just so many opportunities, and I think, you know, particularly if you're in a big organization or if you have really sensitive data, you really have to think through all of the opportunities for failure. You know, I remember I had a friend who worked at a car company on the engine control computers, and this was a long time ago, and he was describing what they would have to go through to certify their engine computers. I mean, they would have to basically map out all of the different fault scenarios and what would happen under those fault scenarios. And I'm not proposing, you know, because, you know, on any reasonably sized network, there's kind of an infinite times an infinite number of possibilities, you know, But I think there's still some amount of, you know, some amount of diligence that isn't being done here.
Sure.
When we're considering,
there's a whole discipline around this called threat modeling. This is exactly what threat modeling is, and threat surface, you know, threat attack surface landscaping is all about, is understanding exactly what you're talking about. What are the likelihoods of things breaking? What are the likelihood ways that someone can come in? What's the 80 percentile I can cover? You know, but at the end of the day, as you were speaking, one of the things that occurred to me is this is still always a trade-off between functionality and business, risk and security. And at the end of the day, if we default too far on the security side, business can't get done. And so this is the careful, difficult balance.
Well, I totally agree with you. I mean, as an IT and a business person, I mean, I agree with that. We are here to support business. But I guess the fundamental point I've got is really twofold. Number one is, I'm not convinced that most security practitioners have their head wrapped around things enough to do a full job of threat modeling.
Agreed.
And number two is...
Wait, before you go off number one, I do want to come back to that, because I honestly think that most security guys are actually technology guys who know how to run security technology, and they don't necessarily understand the security implications and why and where and how that security technology matters.
Good point. That's a good point.
And I will tell you, I am just now starting to become more of a, what I would consider, not a security technology guy, more of a security guy.
Yeah. Yep. The other thing I was going to say is thinking about the likelihood, you know, so as you mentioned, security is a trade-off, you know, it's a risk management trade-off, and you're, you know, I guess not only do we need to know where those threats are so we can accurately model them, but also what the actual likelihoods are. And so I think based on objective experience that I don't believe a lot of people accurately understand the rate at which certain kinds of things happen. So they will, for instance, discount the threat of a workstation, right, to a server environment. And so, you know what, we're not going to worry about that. We're going to worry about, you know, hardening the server environment.
Well, this is the key example I always use. Great, you've got encryption on your hard drive or on your database, and you think that protects you. All that's protecting you from is somebody stealing that device.
Exactly.
But if your network stack and operating system politely and happily and transparently decrypts that data for me when I come in over the network, that's your threat.
Yes. Yes.
Right?
Yes. So, and where might they be coming from?
Right. So, you know, and I could go off on another rant about SSL. And SSL is great for hiding things, including attacks. Right. And what's interesting is we're defaulting to more and more SSL encrypted traffic and more HTTPS.
Yes.
Actually is starting to cripple certain network technologies that are built to, you know, analyze this traffic and understand where things are going and what they're doing and, you know, all the sort of stuff we talk about from modeling to IPS to all that sort of stuff. But
point to point IPsec tunneling between servers is becoming more common, and certainly between data centers in the same organization.
Yeah.
You know, thank you, NSA and Mr. Snowden. That was awesome.
Which has an advantage, right? There's a reason you do that, but it also has disadvantages. It hurts other things.
Yes, exactly.
Right. It's like when we went virtual. It has great advantages, but has disadvantages. And we need to understand these things. And we, as an industry, sort of suck at that. And we also suck at communicating this. We're really bad at getting CIOs and boards and others to understand all of these nuances in a business language.
Amen.
But back to the story. I agree with Cisco. Assume you're owned.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think the article itself did a pretty, you know, didn't do a great job of selling the virtues of that concept. But, you know, it really is a good idea to assume that you're compromised and then plan accordingly. So, and by the way, at the end of the article, there was the normal pandering for more people. Hey, we're way short on security talent.
Yeah, well,
we need more H-1Bs. That's what that's about. I cynical. All right. So yeah. So moving on. The last story we've got is this is kind of late breaking news. Just today, Brian Krebs announced or disclosed some additional information regarding the Target breach.
Target got breached?
I know. You should go listen to the last 10 episodes, my friend.
Sorry. It's been a long day.
So, you know, there's not a lot of, earth-shattering stuff in here, except that some of the information that was previously found is now starting to be what I would call synthesized into, you know, some likely scenarios. So, for instance, the piece of malware that was found in Target was uploaded to ThreatExpert, later taken down. Brian Krebs got a copy. Inside that analysis were some strings like usernames and passwords and domain names and IP addresses. And, you know, those usernames and passwords looked a little, you know, obscure and odd, except apparently somebody found that it's a default username and password for the performance assurance for Microsoft Server package made by BMC Software. Isn't that interesting? There's a lot of new details in here, and there's a reference to a report by a company called Malcovery Security, and that report is actually, I think, probably one of the most interesting things to read here. It's a short read, only about 10 pages, and basically they are speculating here how this happened, how the initial breach happened. So we now know what malware was involved. You know, we saw the iSight report that decomposed the malware and how it worked. We know that, for instance, the POS terminals were packaging up the data as DLL files and uploading it to a central server, which was then, you know, being copied somehow by the attackers out of the environment. But we didn't know how they got in. And so this Malcovery group took a look at everything we know that's been disclosed so far and has seen a lot of parallels between what's gone on at Target and what happened back in the mid 2000s with Gonzalez and his reign of terror on Heartland and JCPenney and Hannaford and NASDAQ and 7-Eleven and Carrefour and JetBlue and on and on and on. They were all SQL injection attacks on external websites. And so they go through this pretty detailed, and again, it's speculation, but having been on the forensic side of this, it seems reasonable to me. And what they based a lot of their analysis on is the file hashes that were submitted in the iSight report. And so iSight basically said, you know, we saw these file hashes involved. So if you see these, you know, you might have a problem. And Malcovery went and found what those file hashes are associated with. And they are things like Netcat and part of the Microsoft System Center orchestrator, which runs and schedules batch jobs, and an IP scanner, and DumpSec, which dumps security configurations. So, you know, your ACLs and logging policies and stuff like that. And, the bulk copy program that lets you dump the contents of an SQL database. Well, that's kind of interesting. The Elcomsoft password cracking tool, you know, which is a commercial tool that a lot of companies use for, kind of testing. and on and on and on. And anyway, they kind of piece together this, what I would say is seemingly logical story about how, you know, they, once they got in, how they, you know, how they moved around. And, you know, it's unfortunately kind of like everything else that we've read, you know, it's, they get into the server, they grab some cached credentials, they brute force those cached credentials. They, because it's in an Active Directory environment, they're able to move laterally. They use PSExec to run software on remote servers. They grab more credentials, you know, and so it goes. This is, it's pretty interesting. I'm really not doing the article justice. I just read it for the first time about, you know, a half hour ago. So there were a couple of lessons learned that I wanted to read because I thought they were worthwhile here. So number one was, and these are formed in the phrase or phrased in the form of questions. Do you have a process for identifying administrative tools that are stored in the wrong places? So one of the points they bring up in this is that a lot of the tools that are involved here are not malware per se. You know, they're not viruses. You wouldn't necessarily expect, you know, Symantec or whoever your antivirus company is to detect some of these things because they're administrative tools. But the point is, are you proactively detecting those tools being installed on the wrong systems in the wrong places? And so that's kind of an early warning opportunity for you to detect that something's going on. Because again, this is how people are compromising companies. They're using these tools. I mean, if you listen to this show and you read some of these reports, at least in my mind, a picture is becoming very clear that the bad guys and girls have developed a very repeatable model of how they're compromising and moving around in organizations. And, you know, I think it's really important for us to learn from that. Obviously, it's going to change over time, but, you know, we have an opportunity to learn here. So the next is, are your servers restricted from accessing the internet? And boy, they really read you the Riot Act about, you know, there is no legitimate reason for the average server needing to talk to the internet. Your server should not be retrieving patches from the internet. They should be distributed from an internal system, you know, after and applied after testing and on and on. You know, it's just not a good idea because that opens up a exfiltration channel. And by the way, you know, it's kind of implied in this article, and we also saw it in the RSA article, that the attackers are starting to use kind of rogue proxies, right? They're setting up proxies on other servers on the network to bypass the normal gateways so that they have some level of comfort that they're not being monitored through the normal proxy traffic. Next is there an inventory of authorized services on your servers? And this was a pretty interesting one because this malware used some, you know, basically set up some new services, and they were named, in some cases, named very similar to other services that are legitimate but not exact. And so if you were, you know, as a layman to look at it, it would look reasonable because you would recognize the name, but it wasn't formatted right. It wasn't what it should have been, and it wasn't certainly the executable that you would recognize. And so it's important to have an inventory of those and know when it changes. Next question is, are system folders being checked for new or changed files? So one of the, you know, what has been disclosed so far is that the point of sale malware was packaging up these credit cards and putting them into a DLL file. Obviously, it wasn't an actual DLL file, but it was uploading it to a server and storing it into the twain_32 directory in the system folder, right? And so if you were, you know, if you were a system administrator and you went into that folder, all you see is a whole bunch of DLL files, which wouldn't necessarily look out of the ordinary. But if you were proactively looking for files that shouldn't be there, you presumably would have seen that and thought to maybe check. Next is there a way to check for unusual protocols and ports being used for internal LAN communications? And the point here is that the malware that was being used inside Target was using ICMP, different ICMP types, pretty extensively to communicate and do some command and control. So, you know, you have an opportunity using most common firewalls and IPSs to look for that sort of thing. And then lastly, and I really like this one, makes a lot of sense, are internal network honeypots in place to look for port scanning and other signs of an intruder? You know, if you set up a system, you know, that nobody has any business connecting to, and somebody connects to it, and it's, you know, on your intranet inside your network, you might want to go figure out what's going on there. That could be an indication that somebody's inside your network and doing some bad stuff. So there you have it.
All good stuff. All good stuff. That first one's really tricky. Knowing if tools are being installed in the wrong spots, that would take some serious attention to detail.
Well, so their proposal was to use something like Bit9.
Yeah, that'd work. Bit9. I was also thinking about something like a tripwire.
Yes.
But the problem is, you know, if you get too many alerts from tripwire, you start ignoring them. Bit9, absolutely.
But then I got to thinking, you know, even if you have Bit9, one of the challenges I've seen is that you can apply that sort of stuff to the systems you know about.
Right.
You know, but if somebody's able to attach a system on your network, either that you don't know about or that hasn't been properly configured with all the tools, you know, all bets are off. And by the way, we've seen that happen.
Absolutely. Well, this means that's why you got to be either doing, you know, NAC is somewhat of a mixed bag, but something like NAC or something about, you know, some sort of active scanning or some sort of, you know, asset inventory or, you know, keeping an eye on these things.
Absolutely.
You know,
That's a big problem for a lot of companies, and I think if somebody can actually solve the problem in a meaningful way.
I think part of the challenge is a lot of folks don't have the resources, right? We're talking about a lot of very proactive, low and slow, you know, low order of return, but highly impactful stuff, which is not what a lot of people have time to do.
It's true. But I guess if someone were able to change the economics of that, so it didn't require so much overhead. You know, I think that would be a pretty meaningful thing.
Yeah, I mean, the key there, a system like that can be easily developed. The key there is that it's all within context. So the context has to be understood and filled in.
Yeah, yep. Fair enough.
And that takes time and energy. And I don't know, some people just have challenges finding the time to do all that. Indeed. Not saying that's a good excuse. I'm saying it's just the reality on the ground is, you know, these things matter. But convincing folks that you're going to spend time, you know, looking at logs to find out when something was installed in the wrong spot, is, you know, as opposed to why can't we buy a box for that sends us an email when something's in the wrong spot, right?
Right. No, that's fair. That's fair. But I think there's an opportunity for automation, but that has its own cost.
Yep. And then, you know, we'll just exploit the automation system.
Well, not that we've ever seen that before.
No. So, Anyhow,
that was all the stories we have for tonight. And I see that we are just at about an hour, so right on target. So anyhow, I appreciate everyone's time, and as always, we look forward to bringing this podcast to you. If you have enjoyed the podcast or have ideas on things you'd like us to cover or whatnot, and by the way, speaking of that, there's 11 weeks to get rid of XP. So Dun, dun, dun. We're going to have the countdown. I think, you know, for that second week in April, we'll have a party or something.
XP is dead. Long live XP.
But, oh, by the way, I know I'm
that's a second, by the way.
I'm protracting the story.
We're now two threads down.
I know. Sorry. Office 2003 is also in there.
Oh.
And nobody's talking about that one.
Don't get me on a rant. How many different ways do we really need to update word processing and spreadsheet applications? I think we've pretty much reached the state of the art on those.
Look, we got to keep moving those freaking controls all over the place. That makes it better.
Apparently.
Anyway, as I was saying before I derailed myself, if you have any ideas or feedback for us, send us an email to info@defensivesecurity.org. Or you can hit us up on Twitter @DefensiveSec. You can follow Mr. Kellett on Twitter @Lurg. You can follow me @MaliciousLink. You can find the show in the show notes online at www.defensivesecurity.org. And with that, I think we'll call it a week. Have a lovely week, and we'll talk to you again.
Thanks, guys. Take care.
Bye.